Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Thank you all for coming out for a poetry reading on a night when there are many other things going on. I'm very proud to introduce to you this evening Cleta Long. He's one of my personal favorite poets in the whole wide world. She's a lifelong resident of Tucker County, West Virginia, which is the county just north of here. And she has written poetry all of her life. But in 1985, there was a catastrophic flood in her area. And she wrote poems about it, just like she had about other things that had happened in her life. But this time, other people had been through that same experience of the flood. And her words struck a responsive chord. And there was a very unusual thing that happened in Tucker County, West Virginia in 1985, where there was a rare kind of communication between a poet with deep roots in a community and a community that was in great need of healing. And I think that you all will find this evening that there are experiences that you also have had where that are similar to experiences that Cleta Long has had, and that you also will find that she has a wonderful way of expressing some of these things about life.
Thank you. Well, I'm very flattered. That was quite an introduction. Last year when I was here, I had to read with Bob Henry Baber, and that scared me to death, but this man is an authority on all of the literature in this area, so that's high praise coming from him. Thank you. I have been writing poetry ever since I was a little girl. When I was growing up back in the 40s, late 30s, 40s, we had to pretty well entertain ourselves. We lived out on a farm without electricity or anything to entertain us except the beauty of Tucker County in West Virginia and the things that we improvised ourselves. We did have a radio, a battery radio. It wasn't a transistor radio, of course, at that time. It was one of those huge battery packs that looked sort of like a car battery. And when it started getting old, it would get weak. It would get lower and lower and lower until you couldn't hear it any longer. And so the last month of the battery was pretty well reserved for the newscast. So we kids had to find ways to entertain ourselves. I had an older brother that picked on me too much, I thought, and a younger brother that I had to babysit too much. So I found a special place that I could get away from all this, you know. And we lived in this old one-room house that had been a schoolhouse that my father had gone to school in. It had been converted into a dwelling house. And there wasn't a second story, but there was this ladder just nailed smack on the wall that went up into a huge attic. So there was the chimney that went up through and a window in each end and an occasional bat hanging from the eaves, you know. That this sort of became my place, and I would go up there and write about things that I'd seen or felt strongly about or whatever. But I didn't allow anyone to read those. When I was in third grade and again in fifth grade, had a very understanding teacher who recognized my need to express myself, and she encouraged me to write and to read to others what I had written. And I even wrote a little play while I was in her class. But then after I dropped out of high school when I was 16 and got married, you know, and I sort of went back in the closet, so to speak, and just wrote little notes and things for my friends, and things for myself. Until 1984, I finally decided that there was an event that I decided was worthy of bearing my soul for, so to speak. My husband's uncle lived across the river from Hendricks in Tucker County. He was an elderly man by this time, and there was this old suspension bridge that crossed the Dry Fork River at Hendricks. It had been built in 1917 with $300 in public donations. It had fallen down a couple, two or three times, and had been rebuilt using much of the same materials. But by 1984, the old bridge was really, really shaky. And my husband's uncle, for the past 5 years before that, his name was Joe Long, and he would go down and look after this old bridge. Well, the people really resented it because they thought he was only concerned with the bridge being torn down and he wouldn't be able to get back and forth from across the river. But the truth of the matter was that he was really concerned that someone would get hurt. Every year in Hendricks, we would have the Hick Fair, and maybe 1,500 to 2,000 people would come into town. And sooner or later, they would all come down to the old suspension bridge and jump up and down on it and all those things. So at one time, I ran 30 children off it, and they thought I was terrible for running them off the bridge, but they didn't realize how rickety it had gotten. So when my husband's uncle died in August of 1984, I decided that I had to write something and put it in the paper so that people would know about the old bridge and why he watched it. So this was the first poem that I ever had published in a newspaper or magazine or anything. And I called it The Old Man on the Bridge. The old man sat at the end of the bridge, his countenance weathered like stone. And the children whispered, "The old man is mad," as he chased them away with harsh tones. And the town folk all said, "What business is his to sit like a king at the end of the bridge?" But the old man sat on all 3 days of the fair, like a troll guarding his bridge. Folks passed one by one, and no harm was done to the old swinging bridge or the townspeople's kids. But they all said, "Pshaw, that old bridge won't break down. We jumped on it when we were young. The old man is just mean," and that's how it seemed to those who passed by in a steady stream. But they didn't know that once long ago, when the old man was young and quite strong, on a cold winter's night by a lantern light, how he fought the dark river to save many a life. The bridge over Dry Fork broke down with the crowd. The river was running with ice. It tore at his clothes and his body half froze as he searched all that night until none could be found. And by his great courage, just one person drowned. But the old man is gone. He won't sit there this year. You can run, you can jump if you may. If the old bridge breaks down, no one will be there but the river's hard rocks, cold and gray. The shallow water won't cushion your fall, a tragedy, people will say, but they'll know why the old man sat at the bridge and chased the children away. Thank you. Well, that one was pretty well received, and I got a little braver, and I started writing some more and sneaking them in here and there, you know. But like Mr. Brosy said, when in 1985, when we had the flood that devastated 29 counties in West Virginia, 43 people lost their lives, and there were billions of dollars worth of damage. I lost a lot of the poems that I had written and stacked away for a someday book in that flood. We live right along the Dry Fork River, and so we were accustomed to how rapidly it could come up. It really didn't concern us because our house was up quite high on the hill in a field, you know, away from the river. And whenever we saw that the river was coming up, We would hurry out to town and buy some groceries and hurry back in because there was a low place in our road that the water would cross. It would usually just wash the top of the road off, and we would kind of be stuck in there for maybe 2 or 3 days or a week until the Department of Highways came and smoothed it up, you know. But we thought as long as we were in there and we had enough food, we would be fine. But on November 4th, that's exactly what we did. We hurried out to town, got our groceries, and hurried back. And by 2 o'clock, the water was over the road. But we were so confident that we even took a nap in the afternoon. And in the evening, my husband, Norman, went out and fed the animals. And about 7 o'clock, we were watching TV, and we heard this horrible roaring noise, just, you know, much, much louder than any noise of the wind or anything that we had heard. And so Norman went out to look, and our car was washing right out of the driveway. Well, I heard him yelling, and I ran out too with the light. And he went down and tried to start the car. He did get it started, but the motor died immediately. And by this time, the water was all the way up to the doors of the car, you know, and into the motor. So he ran up to the garage and got a rope to put around the bumper of the car, thinking, you know, he could tie it fast and at least it wouldn't wash away, because the whole field was just like a river. And so just as he got the rope around the tree, he thought of our horse that was in the barn down in the field. And so he just threw the rope to me and ran to get the horse. And I heard him yelling at me to get out of there. And about that time, I turned the light around, and it was just like a wall of water coming down through our field. And there went our horse, and there went the barn and the apple trees and the fences and everything, you know, just nothing we could do except stand and watch it go. The horse was a 1,700-pound Percheron draft horse, and we thought that surely he would swim out when he got down to where the trees were, but we never saw him again. This is a photograph of him. And if you can't see these now, I will put them out here somewhere so you can see them afterwards. Well, we were totally in shock at seeing him wash away and all this and not being able to do anything. But at the same time, the water was still coming up. And so I said, if it breaks through behind the house, we'll have to leave. And Norman said, oh, it couldn't possibly get that high. So he went in the house to change clothes because he'd ran out in the water trying, you know, to get to the horse, calling the horse. And by the time he changed his clothes, the water was going around behind the house. So we waded out, crossed the garden to the hillside, ran the calves out of a barn and went in there for a while. And after a while, the water even came to there. So we left and went on up the hillside, hoping to get to my husband's aunt's house that was about a mile down the road, but about 3 miles around the mountain. And this was quite a task for me. I have a muscular dystrophy type disease, so you can imagine my climbing the mountainside in the dark. Well, we went all the way around the mountainside till we could see my husband's aunt's house, the lights from her house, and there was a stream between us and the house that we couldn't possibly cross. So we knew that we had to get in someplace. The temperature was about 40 degrees or 44 degrees. The rain, we were soaked to the skin. The rain was just pouring down, and the wind started to blow. So we thought and thought about some place we might shelter, and we thought about some corn stalks, shocks left out on the hillside where we'd had a cornfield. My husband had cut the corn and shucked the corn out and just piled the corn stalks up into what we call a fodder shock. So we hurried back there as quick as we could and just crawled in and piled this stuff all over us. It didn't keep out the rain, but it did keep out the wind. While we were in there, it was even kind of funny. My husband has this huge Airedale dog, and he was on one side of me, and Norman was on the other side. But all of a sudden, this dog got very protective, and every time Norman would move, he would growl at him. Norman, being from West Virginia, of course, chose Copenhagen. Well, he'd forgotten his Copenhagen in our hurry to leave the house. But I had some cigarettes. Well, he doesn't like cigarettes very well, but he finally agreed, well, the nicotine just that he just absolutely had to have, would the cigarette would have to do. So my hands were so wet, and we kept trying to get this cigarette lighter to burn. Well, we finally got it going and lit his cigarette. And he took just one puff off of it, and a big drop of water fell down and put it out. He said, oh, how it put my cigarette out. And I had to laugh in spite of the predicament that we were in. The next morning, we went back to around the hill to our house, but the water was still running through the entire first floor of the house. We couldn't see how badly it was damaged, but because the power lines were crisscrossed every which way, and the water was still just, well, we couldn't even see the car that day. We could see that the truck and the Jeep were wrecked, and that all the outbuildings except one was gone. Our house stayed because there were some big pine trees that the debris piled up against. So we turned and walked back around the mountain to his aunt's house. This time we were able to cross the stream. But when the water finally went down, we learned that our house was damaged so badly that it would be more economical to build one than it would be to repair that one, you know. So anyway, I was writing poems furiously all the time, you know, about what had happened to us, because it was sort of a form of therapy to me. And the editor of our paper came up when the road was finally repaired. For quite some time, they had to drop food into us with a helicopter, you know, the National Guard. And when the road was finally repaired, the editor of our local paper, who was also involved in the flood, came up and asked me to write something. Well, I wrote a poem entitled Thankful for a Fodder Shock. And a while after I wrote that, and it was in the newspaper, Michael Klein, who was a folklorist at Augusta Heritage Workshops, decided to do an oral history about the flood. And he asked me to come over here and read that poem. So I did. And when he found out that I had some more, someone said, well, you know, why don't you put these into a book? And I said, oh, heavens, I couldn't afford to publish a book. We have to build a new house. So Augusta Heritage Workshops agreed to finance the publication of my book. And so that's how my book entitled Pass with Care came about. This is a road sign that's down about Romney or Burlington, somewhere in that area of West Virginia. But I was thinking of a title for this book when we passed a sign that said this very thing. Our signs say no passing or do not pass, but this one said pass with care. And I thought, you know, that's how we pass through the most difficult time of our life, mainly due to the caring of so many people. So I wrote a poem entitled Pass with Care and named my book that. And there was a lot of caring. There were truckloads of food and clothing, just all kinds of things, furniture that was brought in from all over. Maybe even some of you helped. One place in Maryland sent in several cars, and I got a 1968 Dodge Dart, almost a classic. The only thing was, I was kind of spoiled by the power steering, so whenever I went around a curve, everybody got way over there for a long time. I have a few of these books here with me, and if anyone would like one afterwards, they're $9.95 plus tax, and I'd be happy to sell you one. It's in its second printing, and I still have about 500 of those jewels pushing my bed up, you know. Anyway, I would like to read to you some of the poems that I've written since then. In case you do buy a book, you won't want me to read all the poems in that. This is one I wrote while I was in California thinking about West Virginia. I'd gone there for a visit, and I was thinking, you can tell I was getting pretty homesick. I called it Peace in West Virginia. Peace walks the West Virginia hills and calms the raging storm of tired bodies and frayed nerves till the beauty of living returns. It sets the clock of life on hold, lets you catch up with yesterday, while the gentle breeze and the warming sun chases your troubles away. Now I'm sure God created many a place more exciting with bright lights and thrills, but he saved a double measure of peace for the West Virginia hills. A lot of people leave West Virginia, mainly for economic reasons. You know, we don't have a lot of work and all this sort of thing. And when I was growing up, I thought a lot about leaving. And my older brother did leave. I can remember that he hitched a ride to Baltimore on the back of a produce truck. He had $6 in his pocket and one extra shirt. And he's still in Baltimore, by the way. He retired from General Motors. And when he comes back here, you know, it's really exciting for a few days, and then he gets kind of bored with our pace of life. But I wrote this little poem that I called The Hills of Home, and it's sort of a staying at home poem because I never left home. I could have left this town, you know, and went away like you. I could have back when I was young and life was fresh and new. I might have scoffed at royal ties. I might have done quite well. I could have back when I was young, though none can ever tell. But I chose to stay, and you chose to go. We're different, you and I. But I could have been right back when I was young, 'cause last night I heard you cry. That was the one that picked on me, yes. When I was growing up, we didn't have a lot, and so that brother and I would do all kinds of things to get a little money, you know. One of the things we did was to pick berries to sell. We would pick wild strawberries and black raspberries and carry them into Hendricks and Parsons and sell them for 50 cents a gallon. The blackberries we couldn't sell because they were so plentiful that no one would buy them. Once in a while you might catch what we called a city slicker who would give you 20 cents a gallon for them, you know. But usually we canned those. And so this is a poem that I wrote for a Thanksgiving program, really. But a lot of people like this. It's called Blackberry Day. Thanksgiving is rich with tradition, and families shape it their way. But at my home, Thanksgiving was coined official Blackberry Day. For come each November with Thanksgiving snow that catches us quite by surprise, we didn't have turkey and dressing, but Mom baked the blackberry pie. Now that might seem kind of strange to you. On Thanksgiving, we eat pumpkin pie. But if you're of a mind to listen, I'll tell you the blackberry why. See, every summer we pick them, the kind that are long and sweet, and can them up in mason jars stored under the old window seat. And often we hungered to eat them before the appointed day, but Mama just wouldn't allow it, so under the seat they would stay. But with the first hint of winter, Daddy made a trip into town to purchase some sugar in ready for when the first snow came down. And the day before Thanksgiving, when the dark snow clouds scuttled on high, I go for some milk at the neighbor's, and Mom baked that blackberry pie. Well, I still remember that scrumptious taste of sweet blackberries and cream, and no matter how often I make them, it's not quite the same, it seems. I wish we could banish the turkey, the pumpkin and dressing away, and just once the whole world could savor the joy of Blackberry Day. Another thing that I got to do was to go ginsenging with my daddy. My older brother was interested in track and football and all that sort of thing, and since the younger brother was too small, I was the one who usually got to go with him ginsenging. Now, ginseng is a plant that used to grow plentifully in West Virginia. Now it's quite rare. Back when we would dig ginseng, it sold for about $16 a pound. But you could dig 2 or 3 pounds a day. Now it sells for about $200 a pound. And you might dig all summer and not get a pound of ginseng to sell. It's used for many different things. A lot of Oriental people feel that it has some sort of mystical power, I've heard. And that the more the root resembles a human person, the more potent it is, you know. A lot of athletes are drinking ginseng tea, and a lot of health-conscious people, they feel that it does the same thing that steroids do without the danger, you know, of that. And I have a picture here of a ginseng plant that you might want to look at later. I never can find these things when I want them, and I'm not sure if you can see them from there or not. But it's a beautiful green plant with a red pot of berries on it. So this is a story about going ginsenging with Daddy. Ginsenging with Daddy was always a joy. I donned pants and boots, togged out like a boy. Then off to the woods before break of day. When the sun finally rose, we'd be well on our way. And Daddy would cut us a couple of sticks, strong and sharp on the end, to part the weeds and dig the seng and protect us from snakes now and then. The gnats and mosquitoes would buzz in my face. Daddy laughed as I fought them away. They have to eat too, just the same as you, is what he would teasingly say. And in spite of the bugs, the morning was always the best time of day, when the rabbits, the deer, and the squirrel came out of the thicket to play. We once saw some tussling bear cubs. Daddy whispered, "Let's hurry on past." And just in the nick of time, I think, for the laurel began to crash by a big mama bear that snorted and sniffed and growled at our fleeing steps, left in the soft mossy humus as on up the mountain we crept. Now the first one to find a ginseng bought candy at the end of the day, and I think Daddy let me find it, though of course he never would say. When the sun began to lower, we'd hurry back to the trail before the rattlesnakes started to crawl from the warm slate banks like snails. And after supper, we'd wash the seng and take it to town to sell, then off to bed with a lemon drop. Digging ginseng sure was swell. I have one more long one here from my childhood about my mother. My mother was a very strict person, lots different than my dad. But she had a special day for doing everything. And I bet a lot of you ladies can relate to this, because probably your mother washed clothes every Monday too. So this poem is called "The Day for Baking Bread." Every Monday we washed the clothes as sure as the devil made sin. Scrub them clean on the old washboard and hang them to dry in the wind. On Tuesday, we got out the flat irons, and on Wednesday, we put things away. On Thursday, we always cleaned the house, but Friday was bread baking day. First, I'd scrub the tabletop squeaky clean and get out the bread making pans. I'd get the flour, the sugar, the salt, and Mom would say, "Wash your hands." She put the flour in first of all, then the sugar and salt were mixed. Hollow a place for a hunk of lard while the yeast and warm water were fixed. Now mixing was always the job for me, and the dough felt as smooth as silk. I'd squeeze the lard through my fingers and add a cup of warm milk. I'd mix the dough as stiff as I could. Mama said sticky won't do at all. I'd knead it for nearly an hour and shape it into a ball. then back in the pan and grease the top and cover it from the air, set it high on the stove's warming closet so the heat would rise up there. In an hour or so, we'd poke it down, let it rise all over again, then make it into uniform loaves, saving some for the hot roll tins. Now, some folks might like to eat caviar. I'm sorry, I missed the verse. After it raised to double its size and the wood stove's oven was just right, we'd bake it until it was golden brown and feast on the hot rolls that night. Now, some folks might like to eat caviar and great sums for a fragrance they'll pay, but nothing could smell or taste better to me than hot rolls on bread baking day. Sometimes I write little short poems, and this is one I wrote in April that I thought you might enjoy. I called it April's Fool. You know, in Tucker County, we have about 200 inches of snow a year, I believe, and it always snows in April. This happens every year. Each year when vernal equinox gives sun the higher rule, I start to think of flower beds, of lawn and garden tools. Then just when I'm all ready, the north and south winds duel, proving both the daffodils and I are April fools. Sometimes I write silly things, and this is about something that happens at my house all the time. I'm one of those people who can't ever throw anything away. So there's all these plastic containers under my sink. And I wrote this poem that I called The Plastic Container Idiocracy. And I'm sure you can relate to this. Underneath the kitchen sink, all stacked and tucked away, there's a housewife's dilemma that I face most every day. There's butter bowls and deli bowls and cottage cheese containers. They range from country crock tub size to wee ones fit for painters. Now in the drawer to the right is where I keep the lids, and something strange goes on in there. I swear I do not kid. For every time I need a lid, they all have shrunk a bit. No matter how I twist and bend, the doggone things won't fit. Well, I wish they'd all disintegrate, or the companies compromise and make those lousy plastic bowls all uniform in size. And barring this, oh Lord, I pray, I'll recall this rant and rave when next I wash a butter bowl to pack away and save. When I went to a writer's workshop, you know, poets say, oh, another rhymer. When you go to professional workshops. And so I went to one that Michael McClure was at, a world famous poet, you know, and he didn't like my poetry at all. He said that I lived in a fantasy world, and that he was a little put off because I thought that everybody shared my belief in God. Well, I really didn't think my book was that churchy. Maybe it was, but he really put me in my place, and I began to think that I maybe should write in a different style, you know. However, a friend of mine that you all probably know said that he was a narrow-minded donkey, in other words. And I just thought he'd been away from West Virginia too long if he thought this was a fantasy world, you know, that I was living in. So it really didn't bother me a lot after that. Anyway, the next year I went back and Gary Snyder was there. Gary Snyder is a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet who writes in the same style as Michael McClure. Their favorite poets, of course, are Blake. And so I thought, here we go again. But I certainly wasn't going to recite any of my work for him to critique. So finally, though, he came up to me. He approached me, and he asked me what kind of poetry I wrote, and I told him, well, you probably wouldn't be interested in it. And he said, well, let me look at it, you know, because evidently someone had told him about my long-winded poems. And so he looked at my book, and he was so impressed that he bought it. He asked me to send him a copy of Blackberry Day, and he wrote a letter back to me. It's my proudest possession. So you never know what appeals to one person might not appeal to another one. But I have tried my hand at writing poetry since I like to learn about all kinds and explore all kinds. I have written some that didn't rhyme, and this is one of them. And it's churchy. I called it God Sandwich. The quiet yellow leaves drip like melted butter, sliding silently to the ground, spreading a layer of molten gold between the green grass of heaven, of earth, the green grass of earth, and the blue sky of heaven, so thick it gapes the mouth of life in awe.
Thank you, show them the shape.
And I sort of did it like this, playing around with the word processor. I wrote another one that said, they shared one purple thistle, a monarch butterfly, and two droning bumblebees, flitting, buzzing, moving aside, making room for each other. I wish the world could see the way to share, taught by a golden butterfly and two droning bumblebees on a single purple thistle. That's about the extent of my unrhymed poetry. This one I wrote for Bob Henry Baber last year. I don't know how many of you have come back for a second year.
Laura was here last year.
Maybe just
in
one.
In the course, and other people were.
Okay. I was real nervous about reading with Bob Henry Baber because he writes little one-liners like, old school buses never die, they get bought up by the Baptist church. And then he wrote one that I can't say it exactly, but it was something to do with statistics show that the crime rate in West Virginia is low and the auto accident rate is high, which goes to show that West Virginia roads are crooked and West Virginia people are straight, or something to that effect, you know. But I was real nervous about reading with him, and so I wrote this one for him, and I called it Reading at Augusta, and even though it's a year old, it usually gets a good laugh. When I first learned that I was to read with Bob Henry Baber, no less, I thought Augusta Heritage Workshops, you've sure made a god-awful mess. 'Cause this guy can say in a line or two what takes me an hour, I fear. His words sing lightly with music, while mine belabor the ear. Now Bob is a free-thinking spirit, using phrases that to me are unheard. For I'm an old-fashioned lady, I can't even think four-letter words. I guess I compare to Dickinson a bit, and Bob leans more toward Blake. And if you mix tigers and butterflies, your sanity might be at stake. But if you're brave enough to listen, we'll share with you our dreams. And who knows, before the evening's over, we might make one H of a team. So he hugged me and told me I could read with him anytime. I thought that was nice. Whenever I run out of other things to write about, I write about my husband, Norman. He was up there a while ago, but I guess he sneaked out. He knew I was going to do this to him. He and I are quite different, and he couldn't any more get down here and talk in front of you than fly. I do programs at Canaan Valley State Park and at Blackwater State Park sometimes, and he'll go with me. And if I start to read about him, I'll say, this is a poem about my husband, Norman, back there. And everybody turns around to look, you know. Well, when they turned around to look, he did too. So that's how shy he is. But since we are so different, I wrote this poem called The Attraction. We make a strange combination. Some wonder that we belong. I write the words and the music. but you never sing the song. I reach for the moon, you stay on the ground. I'm feeling sad, and you act a clown. If I want the quiet, then you want to chat. And if I want this, then you want that. I doubt there will ever be time we agree. And one day the union may crack. But the guy was so right who wrote the words. Opposites surely attract. And this one always embarrasses him a little bit. Norman worked on Inferno Experimental Force for 32 years, and I have photographs of him here that I'll put out that you can see. For about 14 of those years, he cut timber, and the rest of the time he drove a bulldozer and skidded the timber, winter and summer, you know. And there's even one photograph in here that shows him with snow all the way up to his shovel handle. He had to shovel out and cut the tree so close to the ground, according to the experiment. So anyway, I thought he deserved this poem, and it's just about Norman. Deep-set eyes under bushy brows have a knowledge not taught in school. The long square set of the lower jaw won't allow for bending the rules. There's a strength hidden under the blue chambray shirt that isn't readily seen. It extends from his squared-off shoulders to legs encased by blue jeans. I've seen him carry impossible loads and climb the steepest of hills. I've seen him cut the tallest tree and command a wild horse to be still. He has an uncanny insight about folks he's only just met. He drives me wild with his rightness that hasn't proved wrong up to yet. Now sometimes I long for the easy days before this hard-living man who always makes life more difficult by living off the land. See, he won't settle for bakery bread or frozen potatoes and beans. Everything has to start from scratch or else he gets cranky and mean. But we put up with each other for 36 years, and the reason is truly plain. No one else would have either of us, and so it was God ordained. Sometimes I get a little more serious, and I wrote one called The Cycles of Life. We didn't have a honeymoon, just life begun together. A rented house you brought to me too, in Indian summer weather. You took me hunting in the hills. I packed the sandwich lunch. We sat among the copper leaves and talked and laughed and munched. The second year brought changes. We grew in subtle ways. Responsibilities a child left little time to play. But like the seasons of a year, we've come full cycle too. There's time to walk in copper leaves, just life and me and you. Sometimes I just look out and see something that strikes my fancy, and this one's about a brick wall. I don't know if you ever really looked at a brick wall or not, but maybe you should. I called it bricklaying love. I wonder who planned the way to lay bricks so the cracks don't all fall the same. One row start half, the other start whole, so the intricate pattern remains. Borrowing strength from the row below, giving to the row above. Though the patterns existed since pyramid days, I bet no one's compared it to love. That sounded unfinished.